You're listening to Confessing Animals with Jen Harris and Vanessa Arrico, rebel poets, real rebels, really talking poets, rebelling and listening. Listening.
Okay, don't interrupt me.
We wasted the good surprise on you. Do you remember that from Big Daddy?
No.
That classic that movie starring Adam Sandler. He fucking, is it him? He shows up to a surprise party and they surprise and it's not his party. And then while they're sorting out what the fuck he's doing there, I think is how it goes. Anyway, the person whose party it is walks in behind and gets like the piddled out surprise. And his girlfriend cries and she's like, "We wasted the good surprise on you." And I think it's fucking funny. Anyway.
That's what happened. Jesus.
That's what happened. Okay. Hey, I'm Jen Harris.
And I'm Vanessa Arrico. Welcome to another episode of Confessing Animals, where we talk to writers about writing. And this season, it's all about confession.
I can't even with your, you've gotten good at this in a way that's almost like you're fucking selling me some Colgate. And it's, I'm just, you're doing better than you ever have. And I'm not ready for it.
I love you.
I love you too. So
we're talking to Ashley Parsons today.
We are season 4, episode 5, number 42. I don't know why do we have 4 seasons? Have we established this?
We definitely have 4 seasons, and I don't know why our numbering system has multiple avenues.
I agree. But
writers should not do math. Apparently we can't do numbers, right?
Listen, we did 41 episodes and then we circled back to our very first interview with the one and only Ashley Parsons. And so that's who we're talking to today. Ashley Parsons, she, her, is a queer woman who tells true stories about love, mystery, and embodiment through writing, photography, mentoring, and speaking. She is an alumni of the 2019 Thread at Yale program through the Yale Journalism Initiative and the winner of the Moth Snap Judgment Competition. Her award-winning work as a storyteller has been captured in photographs, films, and multimedia via We Are the Parsons, Huffington Post, American Photo Magazine, and Real Simple Weddings, among countless others. In 2013, she was named one of the best wedding photographers in the world. Since the turn of the century, she has taught workshops, creative retreats, and been a vital part of creative collaborations across the globe. You can find her on Instagram at @FromAshParsons and AshleyParsons.com. So,
and she's an honorary member of the Writing Workshop, KC, where we are blessed to be able to hear this woman's writing every week.
You know, we are too blessed to be stressed, too anointed to be disappointed. Ashley, my life wouldn't be the same without you. So thank you for being on our podcast today. And y'all, just listen. That's all you got to do. Just show up and listen. You're welcome for this episode. You ready, Vanessa?
I'm ready.
All right, Ashley Parsons, you were our very first guest on Confessing Animals on January 12th, 2021, and you talked about motherhood, mystery, the creative life, not necessarily in that order. You talked about your husband. You talked about the memoir that you're writing. You talked about a million beautiful things. I mean, you want to just tell the people, spill the tea. what the fuck has been happening since January 12th of
2021? Yeah. Hi.
Welcome Hello. Back.
Thank you. It's so fun to be back. Yeah, I'd like to take this opportunity to tell my mom that I'm gay.
Hi, Mom.
Mops. No, she knows I'm gay, but I am gay. Yeah, a lot has changed. I went back and like put myself in fast motion chipmunk voice this morning to try and see what did I actually talk about the last time I was on here. And I don't think it's in the recording that got uploaded, but I remember because we talked forever. And then Vanessa, I think you had to edit out like most of what I had said because I just talked a lot. But I remember sitting in my bedroom, in my house, in a turtleneck, which just feels deeply symbolic compared to the shirt I'm wearing now, and trying to be really put together, but also like hinting to the fact that there were all of these deeper stories, deeper narratives, deeper traumas. And I kept trying to like almost put your fingers on the pulse of that without saying the thing. And there came a point where I think Vanessa, or maybe it was you, Jen, maybe it was both of you, just kind of went, what are you talking? Like, do you need to come out or something? And I don't think that that's in the original interview. If it was, I was listening to my voice too fast and just way too over myself to get there. But I remember kind of being like, ooh, uh-oh.
Our spidey sense was picking up that there was something going on that you weren't quite telling us.
Vanessa and I are forever trying to pull everybody out of the closet. Everybody who comes on this podcast leaves gay. Like that's
absolutely that's what happens.
Or they've at least been given like the option, right? Like we'll help you open this door.
I mean, look, so we give you the option to like really have to come out as heterosexual if that's where you're choosing to go. I mean, come on.
Right.
And like disappointed parents, we'll accept it. But if you could not do it in front of us, that'd be great. Okay, so you
love the sin or hate the sin, you know? triggered. No. So what that showed me is that I listened to that this morning, and I think I actually said out loud to myself, "Man, I have been dropping hints my whole life." And it's a really long life to live like a third of yourself. And I think that's what I have been doing. I think I came here really ready for authenticity and connection, like here to the planet, the podcast too, but mostly the planet, ready for authenticity and like connection and wholehearted living. And then I started to recognize who I was and the structures and systems I was placed in, and that those two things wouldn't go together. So my whole life has been a negotiation of my truth and trying to hold out the small percentage that felt palatable and would fit into the vernacular of the people I was around, and then keeping back the rest, the core of it, just for me to kind of wallow in, you know, not to be proud of, but to feel like this was the thing that was always going to separate me from a wholehearted life. So I hear that on that podcast. It's actually like I feel so tender for that girl that came into that conversation. Because my gosh, she was just, she'd been doing so much work for so long and she was so tired. So,
do you feel like, I mean, to be cliche about it, like a huge exhale or like a huge weight has been lifted? Like, do you feel any levity from this transformation?
Oh, the most. The most. Yeah, I don't think I could actually put it to words. I think that the strange thing is, growing up in a religious structure, there was always this far off someday hope that if you do the right things and you say the right prayers and you confess, you know, enough, that there's this someday hope of freedom and of this other place. And all the songs are about it. All the creeds are about it. You get matching t-shirts in high school and go to third world countries about it. You're reaching for this other place. You're trying to get you and everybody else to this other place where the goal is freedom. The goal is wholeheartedness. The goal is, you know, what in Buddhist traditions they would call nirvana, right? Like, it's this, you made it. You made it to you, to the full, true you. And it's strange to feel like I was being sold a lie. Like, and you know, biblically, like when you look at the life of Jesus, what he said most often was that the otherness, the kingdom of heaven is here. It's here. It's now. It's in your midst. And he was always trying to remind people that there wasn't some other place. There wasn't some other way. There wasn't some secret formula. It's right here, sitting at this table with you. It's within you. And I think that, as strange as it is, coming out has made me connect to that freedom more than anything. Like, the songs all make sense now. Yeah, everything that I had been working for and longing for is here.
It just, like, totally, like, reiterates what Peter was just saying, especially on that last clip that we shared last week. Like, mm-hmm. your destination is now, right? Like, mm-hmm. and I love that it brought you into the present moment. Like, you are living in the present moment now, and what is more free than that, right? Like, we're all trying to be present, and you said you're only living a third of yourself, you know, like, Jesus, like, how exhausting, you know what I mean? Like, to not feel full in that way. So I'm just really happy that this has happened for you, that, you know, this is where you're currently at. And I mean, the journey is forever for all of us, you know what I mean? But to awaken to something like that is truly remarkable.
Yeah, it is. And thank you.
I want to be clear that Peter has copyrighted The Destination Is Now as the future title of his book. So,
yay!
Thank you, Peter. I'm so ready for this.
I just don't want anybody that listens to our podcast to think that collection of words is fucking available, because it's not.
It's
get
not
your goddamn paws off it.
I love it. Well, we're lucky to go on that journey with Peter and with you, Ash. And I have, like, another very specific question for you. Mm-hmm. When you were first on the podcast, did you know already that you were in love with Jen?
I did not. I think that I kind of have this blessing / curse. I fall in love with every single person the moment I meet them. And I think it's because maybe it's some nature, like how I was sent here, and some of it nurture, just having the kind of father that I have or had that was deeply loving. and taught me to see the best in everyone. But I meet someone new and I see the infant them, I see the 3-year-old them and the 5-year-old them, and it kind of all hits me at once the first 60 seconds that I meet someone. I just fall in love with the belief that at their core, they must be the most wonderful, wonderful creation. And that I get to stand in front of them for a little while. And so, of course, there are some people that really prove that to be true. And I think that Jen is obviously one of those people. And there was an undeniable cosmic kind of energy when I met her. I remember it very, very vividly and distinctly in that way of, like, my brain keeps reporting the facts back to me of where she was standing, the light in the room. You know, it's all very real, and clearly my heart held on to those facts because they were important intel.
Right.
For later.
So the attraction was there. You just weren't sure what that attraction was or what that meant yet. But there's definitely something. Man, I wish I had some more of your secret sauce, because you're talking about standing in front of people and, you know, being grateful. And I'm just like, man, you know, every time I leave my house, I'm like, why is someone pissing me off? Like,
yeah, I know someone like that.
That's why we have a podcast, because goddamn, we got to get it out somewhere. Okay, so there's a million miles between falling in love with me, with us falling in love, and you coming out. And I feel like most of the people who listen to this podcast know that we're together now. I don't want to not talk about that. But what I really want to talk about is the space between like how you came out to yourself and then how you came out to the world and your experiences with both of those, because, you know, we're talking about confession and, you know, you have to do how you define confession. I'm learning with every episode this season is it's very relative to the person. It's been characterized as divine. It's been suggested as a personality trait or a virtue, something that you can, you know, you can do, but also something you can be or embody. And, you know, where does confession occur for you? Does it occur? And, you know, what is the story of being seen by the world as you truly are?
Yeah, I, you know, growing up a missionary kid, MK, and then a pastor's kid, a PK, confession was a ritualized part of my existence. It was a part of not just my weekly existence, but my daily existence. And built into the Christian tradition, there is this this dance of confession of sins with an affirmation of faith. So even in a typical church service, you will say out loud as a corporate group, like a confession of sins prayer. You will go through a confession together. We confess that we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed by things we have done and things we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole hearts. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We are truly sorry, and we humbly repent. So confession is about, you know, here I stand broken. What the very well-known theologian John Calvin called a worm. You know, here I am, just a worm. And I'm saying sorry for who I am. That's confession in the Christian church. And then you balance it out in the service with this affirmation of faith. And that takes the shape of all of these different creeds, you know, And so in those creeds, you kind of affirm who God is and who the church body is. We believe in one God, the Father, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord. We believe in blah, 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 blah. And you go down the list. This is what happened to Jesus. We're still believing it happened to Jesus. You know, we're still believing that we're these people and that this is our job. And so weekly, to balance these things out growing up, I really resonated with confession, because as soon as I knew that I was different, as soon as I knew that, I think she likes girls, as my shirt so playfully reads, boy, did I have some things to confess. I was busy in my journal, just praying prayers, asking for forgiveness for this, what I was told was a brokenness. And so, and kind of like proof, right? Proof that, right, I really am a worm. I really am nothing more than just a cracked vessel. And I can just hope that somehow Jesus will come in and fill all my cracks. So I think that the beauty of the last 5 years as a storyteller, as a writer, as a mother of a critically ill special needs child, is that I had to start deconstructing who I really was. You know, like when you're faced with the page a lot, when you're faced with death a lot, I don't know, it just kind of changes your perspective. Like, we don't actually have that much time to screw around anymore. And so through the work of writing a memoir that turned out to be just a bunch of pages in a binder that most of them I don't think will ever be published. But through that work, through the work of therapy, through the work of sobriety and recovery, I had to start getting really honest about me, about life in my body and in my spirit. And so I think that, you know, fast forward to my coming out, I think I had done enough work to reframe confession for me, that it was no longer an apology for being me. But the confession itself became an affirmation, you know, of who I am at my core. And that this idea of being divine, of bearing the image of the divine in my DNA, of being good, this idea of original goodness instead of original sin, you know, trying to turn John Calvin's theology on its head and be like, okay, what if I am a worm? Everything I'm making is compost for something beautiful and new and living. So go fuck yourself. Like, I love worms in my garden. I pray for them, you know? It's just looking at the nature of who I am and how I am made and saying, yes, I confess that this is who I am. And in confessing it, I affirm it. It's both. They're both the same thing. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I'm so really, really excited about this idea of confession as the affirmation, because it really just sparked a reframing for me in the way that I look at memoir, right? Mm. Because we all know the structure of these memoirs, right? A lot of it is just like, you know, I was abused. I was like, you know, not to
trauma,
right? Like, and everybody, you know, so it's like, and to me, I was like, God, like, what am I saying? It's like everyone's parents are druggy now. Everyone was abused. Everyone was, like, we've all told these same stories and we're telling them
to each other. We were all raised by losers. God damn it.
Right. So it's like, I'm like, okay, well, you know, it's like the fucking Burroughs junkie shit. Like, everyone's a fucking junkie. Like, I get it. Come on, blah, blah. Like, what else is, why? Okay. If we're going to continue to tell these stories, like, why are we telling these stories or something like this? But I really love the idea and reframing. It's like, no, we're like, we're affirming like who we are. And like, yes, like all these things that happened are part of that journey or something, but like, the part of that process is the affirmation. It's getting to who I am, is kind of like acknowledging like where I stand today or something. So I really like, as I'm in the process of writing something, like, I'm really going to keep that in mind. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's this. Yeah. There's so many titles for this episode that fell out of your mouth, and Vanessa and I at the same time were like, click, click.
Just write them all down. Oh, about the worm, but, like, made me really happy. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I just wanted to get this in there. The only book I have from my childhood, is called like the best book ever. And like, one of the characters is Lowly Worm, and it's like a character that's always stuck, like, you know, I don't know. I think about it often. So it's like, now I'm rethinking Lowly Worm and like, yeah. You know, anyway, so just had to throw that in there. Thank you.
Really loved Ashley's affirmation of like, well, what if I am a fucking worm? Also, go fuck yourself, John Calvin. I want that to be the title. It's not going to be, you know, but that's.
But we do need to make that t-shirt with a picture of a worm on it.
Yeah. John Calvin's in the corner like, ah. In confessing, I affirm. I mean, tattoo it on my body, my dear. Yeah. How beautiful. So what does this mean for you? What does this mean for you as a person? How did you come out to yourself? How did you come out to your partner? How did you come out to the world?
Yeah, it's... I did it like a very slow drip IV bag, which is, I'll be honest, really crappy. Like, it just was so hard and lengthy. It feels like it's never going to end. And I don't know if you've ever been in that hospital bed where you need what's in that bag so badly and you swear it will never be empty, you'll never be done receiving the medicine. But that's what it felt like. I came out to myself on the floor of my shower, curled up in a weepy ball, which was just some reason always the safest place to cry, because you kind of like, you cry, but you can't really feel the tears, you know? And I said the words out loud, and as fascinating as it is, it was a real confession. It was a verbal confession. It was the first time I had ever said the words, I'm gay, out loud. And I had never even written the words. You know, when I say that I've been living a third life, I mean it. I had to codify every page of my journal for my entire life since I started writing. And I used language that only, you know, a twin would have understood what it really meant. And I'm an only child, so that's unfortunate, you know? So I spent decades hiding from the truth and writing it in strange half words I'm worried that I might have an attraction to people of the same sex, you know, like just really, really trying to make sure that if I die today and someone finds this, they're not going to think I was gay. Or I would just call it the struggle. You know, there's a lot of pages of like the struggle, my struggle. So I finally said the words. It was a confession of, it was a confession of being. It didn't feel like a confession of sin at the time, the way that I thought it would. You know, I thought that saying those words out loud would kill me, or at least give me a one-way ticket to hell, you know? And it really just felt like one of the truest things I'd ever said. Just like when I gave birth to my first son, the first things I said were, "Oh, Micah, I love you." It felt as true as that, you know? And then I realized that I had this whole life I was going to have to live because it was the truest thing I had said in a really long time. And so the day before Thanksgiving, very late at night, such a bummer for my partner at the time, my husband at the time, I told him, I need to tell you something. I finally told myself the truth yesterday, and I'm gay. And he said, "I know. And I am so glad you can finally say it, and I am so glad I can finally hear it and accept it, because neither one of us have been able to do that." And I was like, yep. And there had been a lot of, maybe 5 different times over the course of the 5 to 10 years previous to that, when I had tried to just say it in some way. And I wasn't ready to be honest, and he wasn't ready to hear it, you know? So it happened. And then we had Thanksgiving and the holidays. And over the course of the next several months, long, long months, I started very slowly coming out to people at the right time. You know, my boys, my older boys, which was a really painful and also tender moment. It's something it made me really proud of who they were, and really glad that they were my sons. How they reacted was really beautiful. And it was one of those moments that it's like, oh, I will remember this, you know, deathbed, top 10 moment of being loved. It was one of those. And then progressively just told people. But, you know, I think I've always kind of been an emotional whore. Like, I've tried to barter intimacy because I couldn't tell this true truth. So then I just say other shit. I would share too much on the first date with a new friend, you know, and I would know it. And I would know that I was trying to like get some kind of emotional currency with them. Like, hey, I'll give you this thing up front, and it'll like front load the emotional closeness you feel with me. And then you won't come looking, like you won't dig for the real thing. And I won't have to feel guilty that I held back so much of myself. So I didn't do that with this. For the first time, I was really honoring of my truth. Because it was coming out for me was a life or death situation. And, you know, the backstory to that is deeply personal and something that I still am trying to find the right words for how it happened. But I was really choosy in like a wise and tender way with myself. I came out at the exact right time for myself with each person that I told. I didn't force it. And I don't regret it. I don't regret the timing. I don't regret how long it took me to say it to certain people. I'm not sorry for it. It was exactly the way it was supposed to be for me to stay alive. And so, yeah, but it took for freaking ever. It would be so nice if there was like a, I don't know, just like gather everyone in a football arena and fly over the plane with a banner, you know, with like a picture of me with a thumbs up, like, this girl's gay.
Put it on the kiss cam.
That would have been nice.
I really like admire the way how you took it slow, right? I know that feeling of wanting to rush it or wanting to scream it, or, you know, we all know everyone posts immediately on the gram or wherever about what's going on. And I really appreciated, like, I think we have a right to silence and a right to secrecy and a right to, you know what I mean? So, like, I really kind of appreciated the aspect of how you navigated that, because it wasn't, it was some real shit. And like you said, it took time. And you know, it seems like it took forever, but, you know, it, like you said, like, it was right on time. You know what I mean? And you did it in your way in that time. And I just want to know, like, how do you think your ex-husband was able to hear that in that moment too and accept that? And do you think it's just the years of being together? You just chose a good one. Like, that's really difficult. And so, from what I know of how he heard you and how he's responded and how this has gone down, seems like the best it could be for such a really painful situation.
I completely agree. And I think that, I mean, in large part, that's just props to Jeremy for who he is. You know, he, at his core, he is, some days he is still the 6-year-old little boy that he was, with, you know, messy curls and freckles everywhere and just a desire to make everyone in the room feel like they're okay. He does have that tender center, and I'm really just so grateful that I got to be his partner for 20 years. I got to see that there are men that can make you believe in the goodness of men in this world. You know, he's a good one. And at the same time, the flip side of that is that I think he was miserable enough to finally cry uncle. And I think that's the part of this story that, you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it's the part of the story that he's told a lot of his friends when they reach out and they're like, oh my gosh, are you okay? She's done this thing to you, and you poor thing. And he's like, the thing has been happening to the both of us for 2 decades. It's 2 decades of being best friends with someone that you're supposed to be intimate partners with, you know, of forcing something that does not fit and always feels like the monster, not the elephant in the room, like the monster in the room. You know, we always joked about how, like, can't wait for date night so we can fight again. Like, you know, it was the chance to go and sit at a restaurant and be like, this isn't, like, it's still not working. I still get there. And I still can't participate in this marriage in the way that I see my other friends can participate in their marriages. Like there was so much love. There was so much respect. There was so much playfulness. There was so much partnership in raising these kids. We were business partners. There was a whole world of intimacy and being lovers that neither one of us had and both of us longed for. And it was deeply painful. So I think that, you know, he tells his friends often, like, I'm great now. Like, he, you know, he mourns the loss of all the things I mourn the loss of, for sure. Because 20 years is, it's a long time. You know, we grew up with each other.
It's a long time. And like you said, he was just ready to hear the truth because he had reached his point too, right? And now yeah. It was kind of like, wow, we can both just exhale now and maybe move forward. And I mean, it's such a big change. And I remember telling Jen, it's scary when mom changes. And yeah. I knew it was going to be really difficult. The kids are forever. You know what I mean? They're mm-hmm. like, that's just it. You know what I mean? Like, that's never going to yeah. change. And that's really difficult when mom changes. And that might be scary mm-hmm. and it might be difficult at times. And, you know, but they love their mom, right? Like, mm-hmm. no matter what. But it is a scary change. So that is something that's going to be hard for you guys. So I love to hear that your kids reacted so beautifully and lovingly.
Yeah, and of course, there have been many stages of grief since then, for sure. And they get to go through all of those stages in the same way that I do, you know, like, I don't want anyone to be under any illusions that I did this and now it's done and yay, and I'm in love and it's easy. Like, no, I did this. It is an ongoing process. There are days where it does all seem so lovely and too good to be true, and everyone's getting along and being kind. And there are days when I am heartbroken and I wish there would have been an easier way. And I wish that I could make the kind of repairs with my children that would make things easier for them right now. Because, you know, there are just things that I can't fix or touch right now. It's theirs to work through. So that's difficult. But, you know, I think the good part of it is that it's real. I wasn't able, mom changes are so scary, you know? But man, so is deceit. So is this feeling of, I never actually knew this person fully. So is, you know, all the loss and the upheaval that can come from keeping a secret that big for too long. Like, I was on the clock for something catastrophic, you know? And so, which means my kids were too. And so to teach them that life is just that. We're just here doing it today. We're showing up. We're dealing with all of it, the beautiful things and the messy things. And we're talking about them all. And as long as we're all here talking about them together, that's about as good as we can hope for. You know, but everyone is expressing their feelings very organically. And even Jeremy and I, like the other night, we had a problem with one of the kids and he came over and I was crying and he was like, this is the dumbest divorce ever. And I was like, I know. And we just cried. And he's like, this would be so much easier for everyone if we hated each other. Because everyone knows what to do then. Everyone knows what the roles are and how you talk about someone when they're not there in the room. And you know, the kids would have been so ready for it. Like, just get divorced already. You guys hate each other. Y'all are the worst. But that wasn't the case. You know, they've seen us take really good care of one another and make a lot of sacrifices to be in this marriage and in this family. And now both of us are in some ways making fewer sacrifices than we've ever made. We're taking up more space as individuals. And I think that's hard for the kids to see, you know, like, it's always kind of hard to be reminded that your parents are people too. Like, anytime my mom would like get dressed up and kind of be like feeling herself, like looking sexy, and she'd be talking about, I don't know, something inappropriate her and my dad were going to do later, I was always like, no, you don't get to be a person. But the reality is like, wait, you were here first. and you're still here. And I guess that means you get to live your life weird, you know? So,
and I think it speaks to the work that you have done to take up space, to reclaim body, to be embodied in your own life. Like, this is part of the deconstruction in a way too, right? This is filling out in so many ways where you were tucked away and disappeared before.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that can be, it's kind of culture shock for my kids and for me. You know, I still deal with this balance of filling out and being really grateful to be here and feeling real, you know, like Velveteen Rabbit becoming real. It happened to me. And then also those whispers of mom guilt of like, no, everyone's not out of your house yet. It's not your time yet, you know? And even, man, y'all, that interview that I had with you, I said something about being 60 or 70 and really looking forward to like coming into my own at that point. Like, I just can't wait to be that age. And the truth is I would write pages in my journal of some kind of mythical future life that I had at 60. There was some kind of magical thing about that number and envisioning all of my kids had started their lives and they're well established and probably all the people I'm the most afraid of have passed away. And Jeremy and I have gotten, you know, exhausted enough of this joke, like this dance. And finally, in my mind, I would write myself into being in a home with a wife. It was like that. That's when I get to have a wife, when I'm 60. And so to decide for myself that I'm going to take up space as my truest self in my life now, you know, I'm 20 years early. Ooh, there's going to be some hell to pay.
I'm so glad that you didn't have to wait till 60. And like, it's also really kind of scary to realize that you were willing to like, I'm going to continue doing this for that much longer. Like, as if there wasn't an option for you, right? And like, wow, like that's a huge leap from a year ago, a year and a couple months ago, right? Like, I mean, that's a big deal. And especially like for someone like me, who's like never been able to have any kind of filter or facade, who probably is too much myself and too much emotional whoring, as well as all other sorts of whoring, I feel the confinement for you, like, as you look back to that interview and realize like the way you were having to codify the journal. I actually remember codifying my journal too. I don't know why I was codifying it, but like I would only use the first letter of a word as if I was ever going to remember what I wrote. But I can remember doing things like that. And I was like, man, what was I trying to hide? It's so beautiful though, like, because I don't know. It's just such a big change. Change is hard for everybody, let alone what we've all been going through with a pandemic, with war, with, I mean, just being alive. I've realized, like, you know, all this tragedy that's happened, and it's so heightened now. And I'm like, but this has always been happening, and this has been happening every day in everyone's life. And, you know, so it's like, because I keep saying, like, how are we all still living our life? How are we getting up and doing these things? Like, and then I realized, like, oh, like, we've always been doing that. And this is, like, how we've even gotten here as human beings.
Well, yeah, and our capacity for resilience is pretty breathtaking, even just the way that the brain is wired to read a roadblock in a damaged part of the brain and then essentially make new roads, you know, make new neural pathways. I watch this with my son all the time because he has so many different instances of brain damage from ongoing surgeries and seizures, and watching him essentially get detoured over and over and over, and see that, oh, okay, the needle is starting to skip on itself. And then his brain will find a new pathway. It'll make a new road where there wasn't a road before. And I think that, you know, we're all kind of doing that in the micro and macro levels right now.
What magical creatures we are. That's, you know, crazy to think about that. You know, me learning about that in therapy too, like literally rewiring this system. Like, this is possible, that like we're resilient and that we like regenerate and we can find new ways, and like, you know, and we only use like a fraction of our brain anyways. Like, there's still so much we don't even know about how our own body works.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think that's the curse of resilience, right? Because it will, you can learn how to survive anything. You can learn how to be a gay girl and a pastor's daughter and marry that boy that your parents have been praying for your whole life. And you can learn how to make that boy as happy as you humanly can, you know, and you can learn how to have a family and start a Bible study and be the girl who sings every week at church and become a speaker. And you, like, that's the curse of resilience, right? Like, we're always talking about how wonderful it is kids are resilient. We're never talking about how horrible it is that sometimes we have to be. So
do any other species lie the way we lie, do you think? You know what I mean? I was thinking about this the other day. Like, do any other creatures lie? Like, humans, I think number one ability is to lie. We lie to ourselves. We lie to each other. Like, there's so much lying going on. And a lot of it is self-preservation. A lot of it is playing that role, right? But like, I'm really curious if like other creatures lie in whatever way they can lie.
I think that other creatures, you know, definitely know how to put on different traits and attributes in order to be what's expected of them at the time, right? Like, there are gender fluid creatures who have to become both mother and father, or who have to, right? So I think that
the act of deception in order to like procreate is, I mean, among birds alone is is truly remarkable. Yeah. You know what I mean?
The fucking peacock.
There's, you know, there's that little flash dance you got to do to get the ladies. You know, this is hard work. Ashley, there's a million roads we could go from here. But what I would love to know now is, was it worth it? Where do you stand on the slow drip of confession? You know, mm-hmm. I do recommend pulling a Band-Aid off faster, but everybody has their own way and their own reasons. So where are you now?
I love that question. I think that's one of my favorite questions. And yes, it was worth it. It is worth it. It's interesting. I kept using the word trauma and violent. I don't know if y'all noticed that in the first interview, which is fascinating to me. I talked a lot about bodily trauma. I talked a lot about the violence of birth. But I think I was still in a place where I wished I could unwrite certain parts of my story so that I could fully be myself. You know, if only these things wouldn't have happened to me, then I could fill in the blank. And I think maybe I'm just getting tired and like crying uncle to the universe. But I think I'm realizing that this was the path. This was how it had to be. It all had to happen this way. Because every minute detail of my progress and my pain led me to this place that I am today, where I feel like the wholest, truest version of myself so far. You know, I feel like I'm coming home to myself more and more and more. And each morning when I wake up, it's strange, y'all. It's like the best homecoming that I've ever had, like every morning. And I get emotional about it because I'm just so glad to be here in me. I'm glad to be here. And it's like the part of me that was so fearful and so rejecting of my truth gets to like welcome her back every morning. Like, sweetie, we made it. Like, we get to do this again today. We're still here. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it wonderful to get to be here a little while longer? But I don't think I would have been so appreciative if I didn't have to suffer so much. And I don't think I would be so intentional if I didn't have to spend so many years trying to be the person that I, you know, was expected to be. So it had to happen this way, you know, all of it. And yeah, it was worth it. And as strange as it is, I wouldn't change it. Like that's the part that I don't think I could. I don't think I could go back and come out early and end up here, you know, where I am today. In love with the person I'm in love with. In love with the person that I am. I just don't think it would have worked out. Too many things would have thrown me onto a different path. So it had to be this way. And sometimes I mourn that, you know. Sometimes I'm sad about all of the firsts that I didn't experience until 40. It's kind of weird to feel at times like an aging woman and an adolescent in the same 3 minutes. But that's okay too. You know, I remember hearing an interview with Madeline L'Engle, who wrote A Wrinkle in Time, and actually wrote this little primer, this gorgeous little book called On Faith and Writing that I read probably once a year. I love it. I love her worldview. I love her theology. It's messy. It's scientific. It's gorgeous. But she was talking about A Wrinkle in Time and how she had like arm wrestled with the timing of this book, getting it on the page. And she said, I realize now that the book came out at just the right time for itself. And if it would have come out in all of these different seasons when I was trying to force it, I was trying to get it done, I was trying to make it happen, it wouldn't have been right. It would have flopped. It would have completely been a wasted effort. And she could look back and see it like, oh yeah, it wasn't the right time then either. And I think that's the peace of mind I have now, is that I came out at just the right time for myself.
Welcome home.